In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
I've heard a number of conservative pundits this week who seem to think that fixing Obamacare could be easily fixed by applying free market principles. The flaw, though, is there are two issues at play. First, Obamacare is not health care. In fact, most times when people talk about health care, they're not talking about health care at all. They're talking about health care financing, how you and or society will pay for health care. Second, insurance is not a normal product or service that is easily influenced by free market principles, such as more competition and so on. Insurance is a series of bets. The insurance company is placing a wager on your health, how much you will likely cost versus how much profit they could make off of you. Every time they take on a new client, it's a risk. Will that person be mostly healthy, or will they develop a massively expensive disease? So they spread that risk across a pool of people. Think of it this way. An insurer is like a gambler at the racetrack trying to win money, in other words, make a profit. How well could they do if they were forced to pick their horses sight unseen? They couldn't even see it in the barn before they were forced to bet on it. For all they know, it's a 10-year-old swayback mare with a bad case of the strangles. The only way that you can make a profit doing it that way is to bet on enough horses that you'll get enough winners to make up for the losers. In essence, that's insurance as it exists today. So keep that in mind. Healthcare, actual medical care, can, should, and would be fixed using free market principles. More competition, incentives, all the rest certainly would lower the cost of drugs, seeing the doctor, and so forth. Obamacare, healthcare financing, is how we pay for healthcare. And that is a very different beast and is not so easily fixed. But there are solutions. First up, we'll talk with Lisa Lettenmeyer about the repeal of Obamacare. And then in the second half of the show, we'll talk with author Scott McEwen about the attacks in London and the fact that the Obama administration was spying on Trump. I'd like to welcome now Lisa Lettenmeyer. She is an independent insurance broker and owner of HealthSource Northwest. Her website is HealthSourceNW if you're in the market for insurance. Lisa, it's always good to talk to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
So, of course, healthcare discussion is dominating the news this week and whether or not the Ryan plan will pass. And I should mention that we're talking to you Thursday morning. This is before the bill has even been voted on. And so we're not going to talk about whether it will pass or not. We're just going to look at the bill itself as to whether or not it's a good idea. And, you know, I'm looking at this, and one of the things that's discouraging to me is that everybody that seemed to win their election this time around were all saying we need to repeal and replace. And to me, this doesn't repeal Obamacare. Certainly the first three paragraphs of the bill that's out there address things like wording changes and punctuation, removing an and, changing a semicolon to a period. It seems to me if you're copy editing Obamacare, then you're really not repealing it.
Yeah, and actually I've gone through a pretty detailed summary of it, and that's exactly what they're doing. Any section that they wanted to modify, they literally just said, okay, in this section at the end of this sentence, we're going to change it to the mandate penalty is now zero, as an example. So I guess it's probably an easier process than to try to get the votes to completely replace it, because if you look at Obamacare as a whole, it's massive.
Yes.
And even I, and you and I have talked about this before on the air, to completely replace or push a button and stop Obamacare or make it go away isn't really practical, because it's affected so many aspects of the entire industry. Hmm. So I guess in hindsight, what they're doing probably does make a little more sense, because they're just going in piece by piece and saying, what can we do to tweak this to make it better? That's their thought process, I believe.
Well, in terms of tweaking it, what are some of the things that you see as improving the healthcare situation? And to be clear, what we're talking about is the insurance side of things, how healthcare is paid for. And I think that's one of the things that get lost in this discussion. We'll come back to that maybe in the next segment. But as I see it, middle America is really who got the shaft in the Obamacare bill, because their rates are the ones that went up by, you know, double digits. For you, is there anything that is improving the healthcare delivery system? Well, the financing side of it.
Yeah, and so, right, the financing side. So to your point, when we watched Obamacare roll out and who it helped and who it didn't, it absolutely helped the low income and the poverty status. But if you were middle America, what you saw was your rates drastically went up, your networks got smaller, your choices got fewer, and there was no financial assistance for that. And on top of it, middle America either lost tax deductions or they were harder to achieve. That may have been helping them out. So if we look at the new law, some people are calling it Trump Care, which is funny, but in Trump Care, the ability to get financial assistance is now through tax credits. They used to call it, currently they call it subsidies. And the tax credits will actually help an individual who's making up to $75,000 in income, and it's purely based on your age. The current system says you may be eligible for subsidies if you, as an individual, don't make more than $47,000 this year, and if your premium for the standard silver bill or plan is more than X. It's a very complicated formula. So now it takes that complication away. It says it's purely based upon your age. So now younger people who really weren't eligible for subsidies before because given the premiums, it just didn't help them, they're actually going to be eligible for tax credits, genuine tax credits that will help them buy plans starting right off the bat. And the older you get, the higher the tax credit is, all the way up to $75,000 as an individual. And even at $75,000, the tax credit that you're eligible for doesn't go away. It just starts to slide back a little bit. So the more you make, the less you get. So it's just a flat tax credit until a certain income point, and then it could slide back until maybe you make so much money that you don't get it at all. So that's going to really, I think, double or maybe even triple the amount of people eligible for financial assistance. So that's huge.
In terms of the tax credit, is that separate from what they're talking about for health savings accounts? The tax credit, does that just cover your premiums and your deductibles?
That's where, as I read through things, it got a little bit gray. So definitely tax credits, at least how it's talked about or defined for helping you pay your premiums. What I couldn't get real clarity on is if your tax credit's more than the premium, do you get the excess or does it go to an HSA account if you bought an appropriate plan? So I apologize, but that level of detail I was not able to glean from what I was reading through. But it does certainly help middle America. It's not that it's not helping lower income, but it's now shifting that group of people who can get assistance. And if we think about it, these are tax credits that are only available to people who don't have access to other health care. For example, through an employer or Medicare or Medicaid or federal benefits. So we know now that the current situation is if you're an employee and your employer offers you health insurance, whether it's covered in full or majority covered, and you only have to pay a small premium, the amount or the cost of that premium isn't taxable to you. So you have a huge benefit in that. If you're somebody who's not offered benefits to an employer or you're self-employed, you've had very few options to get any assistance for that. So this really opens that door for a lot of people. So I think that's it's a huge positive. The other one is just some of the tax deductions. So prior to Obamacare, you could, if you had a really bad year on medical costs, you could calculate what you'd spent on premium and deductibles and copays and even travel to receive care. So anything that was related to health care within a year, you'd look at that number, and if the dollar amount was more than 7.5% of your adjusted gross income, the amount above 7.5% was used as a deduction. Obamacare shot that number up to 10%. Now it was only whatever was over 10% that was your deduction. Trump Care says we're going to take it back to 5.8.
Wow.
There's also, they're going to remove the cap on the flexible spending accounts. So Obamacare put a cap of 2,500. Flexible spending accounts are when an employer allows you to put money aside tax free to use for medical expenses. When that was capped at 2,500, that hurt a lot of middle America families because they use that to pay for medications and deductibles and kids' braces. So now that cap's going to be removed. It'll be up to the employer to determine how much you can set aside. And that's just two examples of a lot of the taxes that were imposed in Obamacare that really hit middle America when they were itemizing their taxes at the end of the year.
Well, that certainly does sound like it'd be a huge benefit to middle America. All right, everyone, stay with us. We're going to have lots more with Lisa Lettenmeyer talking about the Obamacare repeal and replace. Stay with us. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Lisa Lettmeyer. She's an independent insurance broker, the owner of HealthSource Northwest, healthsourcenw.com if you're looking for insurance. So Lisa, in the previous segment there, we were talking about what you liked about the Obamacare replacement here. What don't you like?
Well, that's a great question. And so if we look, when I'm looking at a healthcare law, and again, you mentioned it earlier, the law itself, Obamacare and right now Trump Care, is really about the financing of it, right? Mm-hmm. And so we need to focus in on that. It's the insurance that's being regulated right now. And what we've seen is an increase in premiums directly proportionate to the types of claims the carriers took on, and that came from the government saying from this point forward with Obamacare, the insurance carrier has to cover everybody, no medical underwriting, no pre-existing exclusion. So as your favorite saying is, the house is on fire and now I'm going to buy insurance. And we've seen what that does to our rates. I was hoping to see something that would turn that back, and that's not coming to fruition. In the, I'm going to call it Trump Care, which maybe I shouldn't do, but in this new law, they're still holding on to no medical underwriting and no pre-existing exclusions, which means we still will have these open enrollment cycles where you can buy a plan if you're in the individual market or special enrollments outside of that. The only real penalty for not having bought it ahead of time is that if you go to buy a plan and you didn't have credible coverage prior to that, you're going to pay 30% more of the existing premium for that first year, but then that penalty goes away. So that's not going to be enough of a driver to get somebody to buy a plan ahead of time before they have a problem, and that's the issue. So if we don't fix that main issue, we're going to continue to see healthcare insurance premiums go up because the claims are high, because people, by nature, tend to be procrastinators. We tend to be lazy, and we don't like to spend our money on things that are not fun, like an insurance policy, because it's not a tangible. We want to spend it on a cell phone or a, you know, cable TV. And so until we need it, we don't think about it. So if we don't drive people to doing this soon enough or keeping it, then we're going to still have a problem. So I would have preferred to see at minimum that there's a pre-existing exclusion, that you can't just buy a policy during open enrollment and boom, have everything covered. There needs to be some kind of accountability for taking care of yourself or at least planning for the unknown.
Yes.
So
talk to our audience a little bit what you meant about that under Obamacare, they removed the medical underwriting.
So each state, all 50 states, had their own version of how you would go about getting an individual health plan. So here in Oregon, what that meant was that there was roughly 55 medical or health questions that were asked regarding your last 5 years of health history. So if it was outside of 5 years, it didn't count. So you'd go through these questions, you'd send in the application. Based upon what the carrier was seeing, they could, and in many cases did, pull your medical records for the last 5 years, and sometimes the doctors would mess up and send them more. And so between the answers on the questionnaire and your medical records, they would determine if they wanted to take you or not. So we call that medical underwriting. Obamacare took that away. So from 2014 forward, if you simply were buying in the right time, which is the open enrollment, which right now runs from November 1st through January 31st, nobody can deny you. You say, I want this plan, and this is how much I'm going to pay for it, and you sign your name, and you tell them who you are, and that's it. They don't ask you any medical questions. The only thing that they can ask that might determine your rate is if you're a smoker or non-smoker. That is it. What that does, though, is, again, people will typically wait till something's going on and then buy coverage, and then look at that. The carrier has to pay for everything, and that's not a feasible situation. Carriers only are able to pay our claims that we ask them to pay, that they're contractually obligated to pay, based upon the premiums they're charging the whole group of people. So if we can't figure out a way to get the younger, healthier people in there to stay in the pool to help stabilize it, those premiums will continue to go up. So going back to the first segment, one of the nice things about Trump Care is that they're taking that tax credit and making it a flat tax credit that's available to anybody within a certain income range based upon your age. So I honestly believe much more people will have access to some additional financial help to afford these premiums. But we need to do something to drive the premiums down. One of the other problems with the law is there's just as I'm reading it right now, at least, I see nothing to do with tort reform, which is where we put some kind of reason and parameters around the ability to sue doctors, providers, medical device people, pharmaceuticals for things that don't go our way. So certainly if somebody has done something egregious and malpractice, we need to hold them accountable. But we all need to remember that the medical profession is still a science. It's an art, and it isn't perfect. And how I would show signs of a sickness or communicate those or respond to treatment is very different than the person next to me.
Yeah.
And we cannot expect the exact same outcome every single time.
That's right.
And so we need to have some parameters around that to make it realistic so that we're not spending money obscenely on liability insurance and more so just the duplication of processes and tests and our medical professionals covering themselves and protecting themselves by doing extra things.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and take a break a little early. Coming up, we'll be answering some more questions there with Lisa Lettmeyer about the healthcare replacement bill. Stay with us. Lots more. And welcome back to iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about healthcare, the health financing side of healthcare. We're doing that with Lisa Lettmeyer. She is an independent insurance broker and owner of HealthSource NW. Website is healthsourcenw.com if you'd like to go visit that. And in the last segment there, we were talking about people that they're really the drivers of a lot of the healthcare costs in the sense that they don't have insurance for whatever reason, whether they're lazy or simply they just can't afford it. You know, historically, people with no insurance, because they could not afford it, they were given care through charitable hospitals. These hospitals were supported through charitable donations. A lot of them were run by religious institutions, and they were supported through those donations rather than taxpayer dollars. Why not have a return to that?
Well, I think an easy answer is it's really difficult to function off of just charitable donations because you don't have a clear path. You don't know exactly what you're going to have, so how many people can you help? And certainly in this particular area, healthcare, the cost of our healthcare system, whether it be the services, the facilities, the durable medical devices, certainly the pharmaceuticals, there's no great way to budget. You don't know what the costs themselves are going to be, nor do you have a clue as to how much of those services your recipients are going to need.
So then maybe the solution for that is supplementing that with some taxpayer dollars, or maybe isolating some people into more of a high risk pool. And I think we were talking off air that there is some language within this bill about it, a high risk pool. But I mean, you do have organizations like St. Jude and whatnot for children that are able to manage pretty well. But let's say that we've got a group of people that for whatever reason, whether they couldn't afford it or they simply didn't get it, isolate them into a high risk pool where they would be quarantined essentially from the rest of the market. So that way, if they do have pre-existing conditions, you would discover that, I would assume, within a couple of years. And then once essentially they work their way out of that pool, then at that point, the insurance industry would have a much better idea in terms of what that person could end up costing them, getting back to the underwriting issues. But instead, in that high-risk pool, what I could see happening is you would have that funded by a combination of things. One is through charitable donations, and maybe you could even further incentivize that. So somebody like, you know, George Soros, who has billions of dollars, he could be donating that at maybe a 1.5 or 2-to-1 type of ratio, so that for every $1 million that he donates, he would actually get a write-off for $2 million for tax purposes. Something like that. Some form to incentivize people to donate to that. But then also finance that through actual premiums that people could pay, that, you know, as long as they can pay something towards their own healthcare premiums, and then finally make up the difference with Medicare dollars. Because you've isolated those people into a quarantined type of market system, would that help alleviate costs for everybody else?
Well, really, we kind of had that before. So going back to when we used to have medical underwriting, if you weren't able to pass that medical underwriting, then you were declined. And if you were declined, at that point, we had a high-risk pool. It was called OMEP, Orca Medical Insurance Pool. It was actually administered and managed by Regions Blue Cross. And the premiums for those people averaged about 20 to 25% higher than the going rate on the standard market. So you were paying a little bit more because of the risk of the pool. But quite frankly, those premiums, at least what I heard back then, typically only covered maybe half of the actual claims. So what would happen with the rest of it, it was funded by a tax to the insurance carriers. So in effect, that carrier who declined you would ultimately be paying some of your costs through a tax to the pool. So that actually worked fairly well. It was a way to spread that that negative claims risk across all the carriers, so not one carrier got hit really, really hard. It gave that person access to a plan that was very rich in benefit and had a huge network and access, and it kept them somewhat engaged because guess what? They were in the high-risk pool because of their health, and they had to pay a little bit more. It didn't mean that you were stuck there forever. If you got to a point where your health changed, you could go back through underwriting and get a standard plan where you had more choice on the type of plan or your costs weren't quite as high.
Well,
we had that, but we did away with it.
Yeah, the wisdom of government. I could even see where you could incentivize people that are in that quarantine. For example, if they go see a medical doctor and get checked out and have some tests run in terms of long-term illnesses or some of the things that an insurance company would be concerned about, something really expensive, and if they pass that, then maybe they can get out of the pool a little early or maybe they would receive some sort of tax benefits on top of that. You could also do things where you tie in like a gym membership so that if they lose weight or somehow take on a healthier lifestyle, there's a lot of incentives, it seems, that you could pass along to people within that quarantine pool. And then again, on the other side of that, when you're looking at entering the broader healthcare market, you would be in a better position as a consumer.
Yeah, and there's lots of different ways we can look at that. And I quite frankly would still, and I highly doubt this is going to happen, but I think if we went back to pre-Obamacare and we looked at Oregon and we said, how is Oregon working? And we were kind of interesting here. We had a very broad, competitive market of insurance carriers, lots of carriers to choose from all across the state, very broad networks, lots of choices on plans. You could buy a really rich plan. You could buy a bare bones plan. You could buy a plan that covered mental health services or not. That was a choice that you could make. So prices were all over the board. If you didn't pass underwriting, you had the high-risk pool. We did have Medicaid, although it wasn't properly funded. So you could absolutely make a case back then that not enough of the true people who needed that type of service were on it. So if you had fixed the Medicaid system to identify those truly at need and help them with Medicaid, we had a fiat. Yeah,
unfortunately, I'm going to have to interrupt you there. We are up against the clock. We'll definitely have to have you back. Lisa Lettenmeyer, HealthSourceNW.com. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson. We're going to change tax a little bit away from the healthcare debate and talk now a little bit more international issues with Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of American Sniper, The Story of Chris Kyle, which was later made into an award-winning film of the same name. Scott has continued that streak with his own work with the national best-selling Sniper Elite series. He has a new book out, American Commander, that happens to be about our newly appointed Secretary of Interior, former Congressman Ryan Zinke. And all of his books can be found up on the iSpy Radio Show. Just head to the store page there, and you'll find links to not only all of Scott's books, but also all of our other guests' books as well. Scott, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on again, and good to speak to you guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And, the other big news besides the healthcare debate is what happened this week, the terrorist attack in London. This probably shouldn't be too big of a surprise that this sort of thing happened in the middle of London, which is now being run by a Muslim mayor. And he's even said that they are willing to thumb their nose at British Parliament and British rule, and they are pushing for Sharia law there within many of the segments there within London. And I think I heard on Hannity the other night that there's something like 40 Sharia courts that are operating completely independently of the British system. I mean, you hear those kinds of things and you essentially have a separate country within a country. I mean, that's prime for these kinds of things, is it not?
Yeah, it's a recipe for destruction. And historically, I don't know of any country that has allowed that to happen that has not resulted in complete calamity, as we're seeing right now with many parts of Europe and certainly now with London, because you basically have these sectors of your society that never become a part of the society as a whole and essentially have, you know, enemies within their ranks that are willing to attack the country in which they live. And that's exactly what we have here with this guy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also kind of shocking that he was actually born in the UK. It's not like some of these other attacks that have happened where they've been immigrants or refugees and decided to lash out at their gracious host country. Instead, this is somebody that was actually born there and grew up with this kind of hatred for his own country. That's to me, is really one of the more shocking aspects of this.
Well, I think we're going to see that more and more. And I just, as we were speaking, right as this interview began, I just got on the internet and see that they've finally released the guy's name.
Yes.
And it's now been 2 days since they had it. But this Khalid Masood is the name of this guy,
yes.
You know, and I'm shocked by the fact that he's an Islamic terrorist.
Yeah.
But I mean that facetiously.
Yeah.
But, you know, from day one, minute one, you know, it was pretty obvious that we had something of this nature going on. And, you know, the press is so reticent to do it. And I earlier today posted something up on social media to say that the reason why I believe they were doing it is because they probably knew about this guy in the past and probably missed the call, not unlike what they did in the San Bernardino attacks where they knew of these people being, you know, bad guys and did nothing. And sure enough, they knew of this guy in the past. He was convicted, went to prison, and while in prison was indoctrinated, they knew who he was hanging with and ultimately came to kill, you know, people within England and after he was a known suspect, you know, within these terror groups. And I just find that the West is going to have to get a lot smarter, or the liberal mentality that allows these people to continue to operate is going to kill people, citizens on the street, as we saw in London 2 days ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what it boils down to is people have to accept the fact that the West is at war with Islam and vice versa. Islam is at war with the West. And it's kind of like thinking back to World War II era. Would you really be okay with a bunch of Nazis, bringing a whole bunch of Nazi refugees into your country and not expect any problem? Would you be okay with a bunch of Nazis living within the United States and not be expecting some problems, and in some cases actually running for a public office? You would be bound to have some kind of problems there.
Yeah, and beyond, you know, the West, the liberals, you know, constant berating of, if you will, our conservative point of view, that we are, you know, insensitive and we don't care about refugees and this and that. These are military-aged males. These are males, you know, between the ages of 15 and 60 years old that are weaponized. You know, so it's not a situation where you're dealing with poor women or children, but, you know, an argument can be made that really those don't even exist in Islamic terrorism anymore either. But that being said, if you want to make that argument, then you certainly shouldn't apply those strictures or those structure of lack of vetting or even watching these guys when they're military age males. I mean, come on, wake up.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing that was not necessarily surprising per se, because we saw it before, but once again, he used a vehicle to mow down 29 people, three of whom have so far died. One was an American. He and his wife were there to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. Again, this is just so shocking, and yet we've already seen it in the mainstream media where they're defending the rights of these people to be here.
Yeah, the rights of these people to kill there. I mean, that's essentially what they're defending is, you know, and you know what else is really, really, the most disheartening is that we still have seen no identifiable movement coming from the ranks of the non-Islamic terrorists, if you will, Muslims,
yes,
to decry or otherwise, you know, otherwise attack this type of behavior.
Yes.
And
yeah,
that to me is the most telling of the danger that we really have, in that the people that the group of bad actors comes from are unwilling to out and unwilling to to, if you will, even decry the actions of the minority that are actually doing these crimes.
Yeah,
and that is very, very disheartening.
Yeah, absolutely. There are no widespread protesting these kinds of behaviors. And a lot of it is simply because in that religion, this is how you get to heaven, one of the ways. And not only do you get to heaven that way, but also you bring your family in as well. So, all right, let's take a break there. Everyone stay with us. Have lots more of Scott McEwen talking about the terror attack in London. And then later on, we'll be talking about the Trump wiretap. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to author Scott McEwen. He is the co-author of American Sniper. That's the story of Chris Kyle, which was also later made into an award-winning film of the same name. Scott is also an expert in the military tactics, strategy, and training. And speaking of strategy and training, one of the things that I was a little surprised about this whole attack there in London, is how close he got, this Khalid Massoud. He got within 40 yards of the British Prime Minister as she was exiting Parliament and being led to her car, and he was just, you know, literally 40 yards away. Is that just a little too coincidental for you? I mean, did this attacker perhaps have some sort of inside information on her comings and goings?
Well, yeah, yes and no. And the reason I say yes is, you know, there could have been obviously a pretty easily identified meeting in the House of Parliament that would otherwise have brought the Prime Minister there. But does it surprise me in that, you know, the access that you have in a place like London that is such a high value target to them, you know, not only the House of Parliament, which I feel is very, very poorly, if you will, defended and as seen in this incident, but also number 10 Downing Street. I used to live in London and I worked for a member of Parliament as an aide for some time in the 80s. Number 10 Downing Street is basically a home, a residence that has virtually no security whatsoever on the entire street. Mm. So now with vehicles being used as weapons on a regular basis, trucks, cars, car bombs, etc., it mystifies me that they would have such I consider to be soft targets as places, you know, where huge, you know, really important officials are known to be on a regular basis. And it's a recipe for disaster. And I think you're going to see, you know, some improvements akin to what you see in Washington, D.C., which I'm well aware of, having known Zinke as a congressman, as well as, you know, what goes on now there. They've got barriers. They've got vehicle barriers. Yes. They've got, you know, they got things to make sure that you can't just drive up and blow something up.
Yeah. Yeah, after 9/11, they certainly raised a lot of security measures and stuff there within the Capitol. I know that Carla here, she went back. We used to work for a publisher back in the day, and we sent some books back to congressmen. And it was very difficult to be able to get up anywhere close to some of these buildings because of the different barriers that they had erected. Do they still not have those around 10 Downing Street or around the Parliament?
No, they just, like, I think as you saw from those photos, you know, you can get close enough to really do some damage, and I'm surprised that they haven't cordoned off that area more effectively. And I would be surprised after this incident if they did not. I mean, they got to bring their security up to the level that they need to with the enemy that you're dealing with, and with a 1,000-pound bomb in a trunk of a car. Let me tell you something: you can do a lot of damage for a widespread area.
Oh, sure could. Well, it'd be interesting to see. Just because of the timing of the event, that he happened to attack right when she was being let out, it'll be interesting to see if they ever release any traffic cam video to see if maybe he was circling the block time and time again until he knew that she was exiting. That would be very telling in terms of whether or not he had some sort of inside information.
Yeah, well, he certainly cased the joint. He certainly knew where he was going. I don't know about his tactics of mowing down pedestrians before he got there, if in fact he was trying to, you know, do a hit on a head of state. So that would be my only question of whether he was using that mentality. Why do you otherwise blow your cover on your way in by hitting, you know, low value, if you will, pedestrians when you're trying for a high value target?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, you know, and should we analyze it either way? The bottom line is the guy should have been fingered early on. And the record that I'm seeing so far right now as we're speaking on the internet showed this guy was a bad dude for a long time.
Yes.
And, you know, this is the type of thing we can expect you know, unfortunately, from this group of homegrown terrorism that we're seeing more and more in the West, not just in England.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, like you said, he had a long arrest record. His first one was back in 1983. He had other arrests occurring up until 2003. Never arrested for any terrorism activities, though, so you can't help but wonder if he was radicalized once he was in prison. And, of course, that's where the Islamists go. We have talked with him as a former cultural jihadist, and he said that was one of the populations that they would specifically target, those within the prisons, because they were already disaffected by the systems in which they were living.
Sure.
Well, let's actually take a break a little bit early here. We have quite a few questions here about the Trump wiretaps and some new revelations this week that, in fact, he was being wiretapped. Stay with us. Lots more with Scott McEwen. Welcome back in our final segment now with author Scott McEwen. He's the co-author of American Sniper, and Scott also has his own series, Sniper Elite Series. All of those can be found on iSpyRadio.com. Just head to the store section there at the top of the page. And we've been talking about the terrorism in London, and now I'd like to turn a little bit to the terrorism happening there within Washington, D.C. You know, we've got Comey there continually defend that there is no wiretapping of phones, no surveillance of Trump or his people, and then all of a sudden news breaks that Nunez, I think is how you say his name, had a news conference where he said, yeah, you know what, intelligence agencies have shown me documents that he was being surveilled. This is a huge nuclear bomb being launched in the middle of all of this.
Yeah, I don't know, and I think your listeners should really reflect upon how deep that revelation is. And
yes.
and because we've taken a step, and I personally consider it to be one of the most graphic acts of internal espionage in the United States since World War II, if not in the history of the country.
Yes.
And the reason being is this. We don't have political parties trying to spy on each other or get each other's information a la Watergate. We have a head of state leaving the office of president who is trying to otherwise wiretap and destroy the incoming president who he has just lost to. In other words, yeah. These acts are not just before the election. These acts were after the election from what we know so far, and they involved a huge amount of espionage that was being done by the outgoing president's minions. Now, whether we're going to tie it directly to the office of president or not, it's another tougher zone. You're going to have to put people really on jail time or the potential of jail time for them to admit that. So do I know that they're going to say, oh, Barack Obama said do this or not? I don't know that right now, but I definitely know it's his administration. I definitely know it's people that are acting directly on orders from his people that are wiretapping an incoming president and his transition team. Absolutely unprecedented, absolutely illegal, and absolutely something we as a democracy cannot have happen.
No, absolutely not. And there needs to be a firewall there between the incoming and outgoing administrations, for sure. So do you think that this is really a prime example of an actual shadow government going after President Trump?
I really believe that that's exactly what it is. And that's what's really weird, is that term deep state, as conspiratorial and nefarious as it may sound, is absolutely appropriate from what we've seen so far.
Hmm.
And the guy that was doing that, Nunez, that was saying this yesterday, I find his reaction very interesting, because he went from the information he obtained directly to the White House, then went out and talked to the press. And when he was talking to the press, the guy was rattled. I mean, you could tell, you could see that this guy was rattled during his interview. And, you know, I was thinking, as I was watching it, as strangely as it may sound, that he wanted to get this information out before somebody killed him.
Yeah.
And that's how bizarre my reaction was, is this guy is so freaked out. He wanted to get this information out, so he was no longer the only source of it, because I think he was seriously afraid that somebody from the quote shadow government, the NSA, CIA, whoever this is going to fall upon, and it will fall pretty high up, would be willing to let's just say decapitate the source of the information. And that's really, you know, as strange as that may sound for me to say it, I honestly believe that that's how deep this probably is going.
No, I don't think that sounds strange at all. And I say that for a number of reasons. Number one is because if this was some low-level technician that was leaking this information, he would have been exposed months ago. And, right. and that's what tells me that somebody pretty high up ordered this and was aware of it and was the ones that were leaking this.
Yeah. And you know, we know for a fact that the leaks that were done, that Obama allowed an unprecedented decision, allowed this information that was being collected from whatever source, NSA, CIA, but whatever source it was, either through wiretaps or maybe even through FISA warrants, but we don't think this was through FISA warrants, that they then disseminated this amongst 10 different plus agencies so that nobody would know where the leak came from. So that's exactly what they did. And now we have a situation where we realize that it was much deeper than that. So I mean, it's really unprecedented what we're going through here. And you know, when we say that Donald Trump needs to clean the swamp, he's got to drain the swamp. He's got to put in some napalm. And he's got to bring a fire extinguisher, or he's got to bring like a blowtorch in and light the damn thing.
Yeah.
Because I'm telling you, this is bad. This is bad.
Well, he's going to have to. And I hadn't really put that together until I heard you talking there about Nunez there being afraid for his life. And I think there's some real possibility for that.
Yeah.
Because if they're willing to tap an incoming president like this, why wouldn't they be willing to kill somebody?
No, I mean, literally, these people, this is government employees that realize that their existence, possibly their very jobs, if not lives, are at risk as a result of their activities. So, I mean, you know, it's certainly their liberty, you know. So, I mean, he's up against a really, really sophisticated group of people that have drawn themselves into, unfortunately, the world of Barack Obama, I believe, and that whole administration where lawlessness was run at a level that I don't think this nation has ever seen before, and I hopefully will never see again. And we're just starting at the top of it right now, exactly how deep it went.
Yeah. Oh, I think so, for sure. Well, here's the big question then is, do you think somebody will actually see jail time? And I think if somebody sees jail time, that's when the rest of them will start singing.
Exactly. You've got to put people up to where they're looking down the barrel of 5 to 10 years. And when they're looking down the barrel of 5 to 10 years, they'll start cutting deals on the rats above them. And that's when you're going to really get to the bottom of it. And a good prosecutor, of which, you know, Sessions is one, or whoever else they choose to do it, can certainly do it. You know, they're going to try and keep this ruse going that there was information going to the Russians, therefore it was justified. There was information going to the Russians, the bogeyman, the Russians, this kind of crap, which is absolutely unfounded, number one. And number two, it's a crap excuse anyway to spy on your own people. I don't care if they are talking to the Russians. Everybody talked to the Russians. The Democrats did. The Republicans did. If you say that's above board or too much or whatever, that's an argument. Spying on your own incoming a president is illegal, and you cannot have it.
Exactly right. And the real tell on that is only the Trump conversations have been leaked. We know that Hillary Clinton was meeting with those same people. Why weren't any of her conversations leaked?
Exactly. Exactly. And you know what? I mean, this whole leaking of the conversations, like there's something nefarious there. Everybody does it. Talking, you know, there's all these conversations that take place between administrations. When you have day one coming into this thing, this has happened throughout the history of this country. I mean, that whole act that they say was violated potentially, or that's 150 years old. Look, let me tell you something. You want people that have nuclear weapons to be able to talk to the other country that has nuclear weapons as you're transitioning the government in. You do not want that activity to be illegal, because let me tell you something. From day one, when you got your finger on the button and you got to be able to deal with the other side, I hope somebody is talking.
Yeah.
I truly hope that they're talking.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know?
Scott, unfortunately, we're up against the clock here with you. I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks you guys so much. And, you know, and as we said before the show, I'm sorry for the loss recently of Carla's dad. And you know, life goes on, and you know, and I'm pleased to see you guys are running such a great program, which you always do, and exposing the things that need to be exposed. I mean, I really appreciate your show.
Well, thank you so much for that. That is all of our time for today. We certainly hope that you're at least a little wiser than when you got here. That is all of our time for today. Be sure to check iSpyRadio.com for some important links mentioned during today's show, and also be sure to check out our new store page there on iSpy Radio. We not only have all of Scott's books, but all of the books from all of our guests from iSpy listed in one easy location. We always appreciate it when you share iSpy Radio with your friends and family on Facebook or Twitter, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.